When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain, and you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
Hi, I'm Mark Larrañaga, and thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. If you didn't hear Sapora Berman's name in 2007, you just weren't paying attention. She was one of the stars of Leonardo DiCaprio's viral epic, The 11th Hour. She turned Paris Hilton green. And when she was in Bali last month, I think she turned Canada's environment minister several shades of purple. To kick off the new year, we've got a special two-part interview with Sapora Berman talking about forest ethics and forest politics.
You were just talking about your 15 seconds of fame. So why don't I ask you about that first? How did the entire... Actually, I'll start with something else because it just seems too out of left field.
No, it's all right.
Really?
I'm there.
You're good?
We were just talking about 11th Hour. You mean how did the whole 11th Hour thing happen?
Yeah, how did you get involved with the 11th Hour?
I was at an amazing conference that happens in Marin every year called Bioneers. And I was speaking there on my journey from blockades to boycotts. And after my speech, I was standing outside, and there were some people talking, and I could hear them going, well, we've got David Suzuki talking about this, and we've got Paul Hawken talking about this, and Gorbachev saying this, but we don't have anyone in this whole film who can tell us about the state of the world's forests. So I'm not shy. So I turned around to them and said, well, I think you need to look at the World Resources Institute data that's showing that 80% of the world's forests are intact forests are already gone. And there are only three countries left in the world with enough forests to maintain biodiversity and ecosystem services, and it's Canada and Russia and Brazil, and five of them kind of the really intense LA types, you know, Hollywood types, are all chain smoking, and they kind of turned around to me en masse and said, who are you? And it turned out that they were all the producers and directors of 11th Hour. And 2 weeks later, they flew me to Hollywood and interviewed me on the state of the world's forests for the film. And they interviewed me for, you know, hours. And then, you know, they interviewed 80 people for that film, and I think there were 40 people who ended up being in the film, and I was one of them.
Very cool. You mentioned at the 11th Hour premiere in Vancouver, you talked about getting more press for saying hi to Paris Hilton than you had for what seems like a lifetime of environmental activism.
Yeah.
How? Why?
Well, the producers called me in July, and they said, we screened the film at Cannes, and it got a standing ovation, and Warner Brothers International has offered to buy it. And if they do that, it looks like the premiere will be really soon. Like, within the next month, will you come to LA for the premiere? And I was, you know, one of the only Canadians, one of the only women in the film, and I'd really connected with Layla and Nadia, the producers, and so I said, okay, I'm going to try. And then all of a sudden I thought, how, you know, when is this going to happen again? I'm in a Hollywood film, going to go to LA and meet Leonardo DiCaprio. I'm going to do it up. I'm going to do it right. So I called a bunch of friends I know. Do you know anyone who knows anything about PR in LA? Because I'm saying this about Canada in this film. Maybe we can use it to help on the issues. And so we ended up hiring a publicist. And I held this little event the evening after the premiere for the organization that I founded, Forest Ethics. And two things happened. One is that the press went crazy. Canadian press, you know, went hard with the, you know, young Canadian activist walks the red carpet. Or maybe they didn't say young. Maybe I'm just flattering myself now. But they said Canadian activist walks the red carpet.
Well, I do think what you were just saying, you're not only one of the only women in the movie. Are you almost the youngest person in there besides DiCaprio?
I think I might be. That's true, yeah. And so
it's a lot of
There are a lot of older male scientists. Yeah. Anyway, so the Canadian press went crazy, and it gave me an incredible opportunity to talk about what's happening in Canada's forests and why Canada's forests are so important, and also about global warming. And the next night after the premiere at the Forest Ethics event, in walks Paris Hilton and Adrian Grenier from Entourage and a number of other celebrities who had heard about Forest Ethics and our event in 11th Hour, and they decided to come. And I had this, you know, I had about 30 seconds to decide, because when Paris Hilton walks into the room, so do 100, you know, paparazzi, you know, trailing her. And
she really has her own entourage like that.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Like, her car pulls up, and then all of a sudden there's other cars screeching, and there's police, and people are putting up, you know, barriers, and you know, some woman comes up to me, and, you know, I'm Paris Hilton's blah, blah, blah. She's here. She'd like to be briefed on who Forest Ethics is and what you do, and do you want your picture taken with her? And I had this, like, you know, 30 seconds to go, okay. And so I walked over to her, and I said, this is what we do, and this is why I think it's important, and I'm glad you're here. And she said, great. And we stood together, and I, the photos are hilarious because she's doing this, you know, fabulous little sexy pose, and I look like a deer in the headlights, you know, just it all happens so fast, and 100 flash bulbs are going off, and people are screaming at you, you know, what are you wearing, and why are you here, and all this. It was really, it was a zoo. It was totally crazy. And so, you know, I was probably with her for all of 2 minutes, briefed her, had a brief chat with her, thanked her for coming, talked to her about, you know, forest ethics and how important Canada's forests are. And then, you know, we helped sneak her at the back door, and, you know, she got a copy of the film so she could see it at home. And it was an amazing thing. So she leaves, and then all of a sudden, 100 people go running out, stop traffic, jump in their cars and screech after her to chase her because she's going home. You know, the whole celebrity thing is very bizarre. And that 2 minutes went on the front page of almost every newspaper in Canada, in full color above the fold, and my phone started ringing, and my phone didn't stop ringing for about 2 weeks. I did more interviews back to back with, you know, every press outlet and strange press outlets, you know, like Entertainment Tonight Canada, and, you know, all these, you know, kind of, I'm used to doing news interviews, yeah. And so this was a lot of celebrity press and a lot of, and it was great because they'd all say, what's she like, and have you met Leonardo DiCaprio, and I'd say, well, you know, they're very concerned because, and just start talking about the issues. And so it was a great opportunity.
Well, I mean, you're coming from Greenpeace, probably, you know, the original media savvy organization. But even coming from that, did you ever imagine that level of bizarre interest in meeting one celeb?
No.
Because I remember Paul Watson actually told me years ago about bringing Brigitte Bardot out.
Uh-huh. Which is, sure.
And how that was the only way to get attention to the seal hunt.
Yeah.
Now, so I'd actually assumed that you'd called Paris Hilton up to get attention, just the other way around.
No, she just showed up at our event. I mean, I had a publicist, no question. Yeah. I was trying to ride this thing. As my friend Ben Jones sent me an email, and he said, in the hood, we say ride that till the wheels fall off, you know? And I was taking the moment and going with it because I think it's important that we do everything we can to raise awareness on these issues. But I didn't know Paris Hilton. And I remember, you know, she walked in, and as you see her image so much every day, you know, that she was like a cardboard cutout or something. I had to, like, took me a second to go, oh, she's real. That's her. She's here. And what a strange thing, you know, that kind of celebrityness is. You know, I got this wave of enthusiasm and interest in the issues on my Facebook page and all over the place from 14-year-old girls. You know, my niece was going crazy. All of a sudden, she was like, she really wanted to know about the issues and she wanted to understand them. And she, you know, because they heard about it, because they saw a picture of me with Paris Hilton.
It's funny. I had assumed, of course, this got big play in BC. I mean, and that's where I read the media about it. And it wasn't until you were talking the 11th hour that I realized, oh, my God, it was everywhere.
It got big play not just in Canada. It got play all over the world. Paris Hilton going green. Like, we probably did as much for her image as she did for the issue, which is fine. You know, and it really did get play all over the world. And then about 2 weeks later, she was photographed walking down the street in Toronto on Queen Street wearing a T-shirt that said, what if this was the last tree, and had a little sapling on it or something. And so she's, you know, starting to think about these issues. And
nice. Have you ended up being involved with her since?
No. I did send her some of the clippings and a thank you package and a big picture from the Great Bear Rainforest and offered to give her a tour. And and Forest Ethics is talking some with her and some of the other celebrities that we met about engaging them in our next big U.S. campaign. We're going to be launching a campaign to ban junk mail, because junk mail in the U.S. is 100 million trees a year. And we think that if we're able to reduce the stream of junk mail by just 25%, it'll be the equivalent of taking a million cars off the road, because we're taking these old-growth carbon storehouses, we're logging them, we're making them into paper, we're trucking them from the mills to people's houses, and then 90% of it is never read and just gets trucked to a landfill or recycling depot. The whole system is a crazy use of resources and contributor to global warming. So that's Forest Ethics' next big campaign in the United States is going to be to ban junk mail, and I think it's going to be a massive popular effort, and it'll be really important to have celebrities engaged in that.
So this is just a U.S. campaign. It's not a Canadian campaign, too?
So far, not a Canadian campaign. We're hoping to launch it in both countries, but I'm not sure. Forest Ethics runs campaigns in Canada and the U.S. and Chile, and we have different priorities in the different countries. You know, the amount of junk mail in the U.S. is so much bigger than in Canada, and simply because of the population, that we can have a much greater impact in a shorter period of time on legislation in the United States. The campaigns that we're looking at prioritizing in Canada is greater protection of the inland temperate rainforest and also the boreal forest conservation initiatives. But the one that I'm really excited about is I'm in the planning stages for a campaign on the tar sands.
Oh, very exciting.
Yeah. There's just no question in my mind that, you know, what's happening in the tar sands is the biggest environmental issue, and I think actually will become a massive constitutional issue in Canada. You know, Canadians have such a high environmental awareness now, and you see everyone from municipalities to companies to individuals, you know, struggling to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, and so few people know that our country is in the process of creating the largest single fossil fuel development project in the world. In fact, it is now considered the largest industrial project of any kind in the world. The scale is staggering.
I get the impression people know the scale, but they don't know the cost.
Right. Well, and the cost is that over the next 10 years, it will contribute massively to our increasing our emissions at a time when we've committed to the world under Kyoto that we will reduce our emissions. So even if we all change our light bulbs and buy a Prius and municipalities try and go carbon neutral, it won't matter because the tar sands negates everything. And under the Harper government, under the new intensity targets, they can just continue to be pumping out fossil fuels and emissions at an incredible, incredible rate. I think it was Pembina Institute has a great report on this that says that we're actually set to increase our emissions, you know, by over 50% just because of the tar sands.
I always figured this was why Harper couldn't look at Kyoto with a straight face.
It's exactly
because
why.
Here he is. He's the prime minister from Calgary, and you know, that's where his financial support is coming from.
Yeah.
So how do you?
Yeah. No, what the tar sands does is continue to feed the U.S. addiction for oil, and it's oil at such a high cost. I mean, one barrel of oil from the tar sands takes three times as much energy as a barrel of oil from anywhere else because of the amount of energy that you have to use to produce the oil. First, you're logging the boreal forest to get at it. Then you're mining into the sand and this massive heat and water vapor processing that is fueled from coal bed methane operations and natural gas operations all over the place.
Well, also, the water supply in Alberta isn't...
Yeah. I mean, the amount of water that's being used to process the tar sands is staggering. Do you know there are now 51 square kilometers of toxic lakes? You can see them on Google Earth. 51 square kilometers of toxic lakes. Those are the tailing ponds from the tar sands. There are people employed just to rake the dead birds off the top of the tailing ponds. It's the biggest toxic nightmare almost anywhere in the world. And the tar sands are almost entirely exempt from all air and water regulations so that we can allow the fuel of the rapid pace of development. So in my mind, there's no question that this is the issue that we as Canadians need to be addressing, and we need to stop the expansion of the tar sands right away.
How are you addressing this? Like, what are you trying to do?
I'm giving away my secrets.
Oh, okay. No. All right.
Instead
of what are you trying to do, what do you think we should be doing? What do you think people listening to this should be doing?
I think individuals should be writing not only to our MLAs and MPs, but directly to the Prime Minister and saying that we need strong emission reduction legislation in Canada and a cap and trade program, and that these intensity targets that the government is pushing will not work, that every industry, including the oil and gas industry, should have their emissions capped, and that's the only way that we're going to fight climate change. and we need an immediate moratorium on development in the tar sands. I think that it's fine for people to talk about changing their lifestyle, and it's good, but it's not going to help us. In the end, what we need is strong legislation. And we could have every Canadian change all their light bulbs, and we still wouldn't be as a country anywhere near to reducing our emissions. We need to engage in civil society, and I think that means signing up and being a part of environmental groups, and it means writing letters, and it means hopefully people hitting the streets.
Where do you see the constitutional crisis coming in?
Well, Alberta has a heck of a lot of control over the tar sands, but this is a national and international issue that is deeply affecting the future of Canada. And so, you know, well, we'll see what happens in the next federal election, but at some point it could become a constitutional issue.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's Peter Lougheed that's saying that, not me.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can see more talk of Alberta separatism again, all sorts of things like that.
But the interesting thing is, if you look at the polls, Albertans are supportive of a moratorium. They're scared because the rapid pace of development is affecting every facet of their lives. And, you know, from cities expanding without the social infrastructure to no water to, you know, the toxic imprint of the massive expansion of the coal-bed methane in order to fuel the tar sands. I mean, Albertans want to see a moratorium, and we're, of course, incredibly supportive of the royalties, but it's not enough just to make money.
I've got a good friend who used to live way outside of Calgary. Now he lives sort of outside of Calgary,
exactly.
And his organic cattle farm is surrounded by hobby farms.
Right.
And I suspect his organic cattle farm will soon be a hobby farm,
right. Because
that's all there is left in that area.
Yeah. I think, talking about trees, it's one of the really untold stories of the tar sands, is that incredible, intact, lush, boreal forest, original forest, is being destroyed for the tar sands. I mean, the tar sands lie under the boreal forest. So there's a massive logging project going on to get at that oil as well.
It's funny, because in my imagination, that's a barren area.
Well,
when people talk about the tar sands, I don't think boreal forest. I think, not tundra, but, you know, basically nothing. I think devastation.
Stunning intact forest that is home to billions and billions of waterfowl. Like, some of the most important areas as nursery and breeding ground for North America's birds. And some of the most beautiful and incredibly important freshwater areas. I mean, the boreal as a whole has more fresh water than any other ecosystem on Earth. And these areas in Alberta are absolutely stunning. I mean, and so at a time when we should be figuring out not only how to stem global warming, but how we're going to adapt to a changing climate, we're destroying the healthy, functioning ecosystems that we have that are our natural air and water filtration systems. I mean, these forests hold the key to our being able to function in the world in a changing climate. It's, you know, it's insanity.
Okay. Can you talk about how you got involved in this in the first place? How you ended up at your first protest in the Clapquot?
Probably the beginning for me was seeing an image in a slideshow at the University of Toronto in a geography class, 1991, of the temperate rainforest, and it was of the Carmona Valley. And I remember sitting there thinking, how is it that I know so much about the Amazon, and I didn't even know Canada had rainforests? And, you know, at this point, I'd traveled a bit. I'd been to Europe. I'd been, you know, the Middle East. I'd been around. And I, you know, hadn't spent much time in British Columbia at all. And it just seemed so, you know, crazy to me as a Canadian and an environmentalist that I knew so little about these forests. So I literally donned a black backpack. I had $200 in my pocket and got a plane ticket and came to BC that summer, 1991. I knew no one. And I stayed at the youth hostel, Jericho Beach, and made my way down to the Western Canada Wilderness Committee office and walked in and said, I want to volunteer in the rainforest. I cook. Sign me up. And after days and days of literally sitting in the office and licking envelopes and doing anything anyone would give me to do, finally one day, Paul George walked out of his office, and in that Paul George way, you know, he's all disheveled. He says, "Is that girl still here? Well, someone take her up to the camp. I mean, she's just going to sit here all summer. Someone take her up to the camp." So Joe Foy was going up to the Carmona camp. They were doing research on marble murrelets. And he offered to take me up to the camp, and I could help cook and just support the research teams. So I did. I went to the Carmona, and I spent the whole summer there cooking and building trails. And I carried the sound boom for Battle of the Trees when Randy Stoltman was being interviewed measuring the trees down in the Nimitz Valley. And then I went back to school in September to Ontario, and I had fallen in love. I mean, I was so in love with that rainforest. So I decided to come back my second summer. And I came back the second summer, and an area that we had been studying in the Walbrun, that was marble murrelet habitat, that I had just fallen in love with. I mean, this lush Sitka spruce grove that, with this deep, deep pool and a waterfall, and we used to swim there every morning, and after we did our murrelet counts. And I came out the second summer, and it had been completely logged. Just the whole entire valley was gone. And I just stood in the center of it and thought, it's going too fast. And at the time, I was trying to decide. I was an undergraduate, science or law, or, you know, how am I going to approach these issues? And all of a sudden, I just, a sense of urgency and outrage hit me that I just never felt before. And just by luck, the next day, this van pulled up to the Carmona camp, and a bunch of people who were going up to Clackwood Sound to join the blockades. That was 1992. And I hopped in the van, and I'd never been to a protest in my life. I was an academic.
Okay.
And I went to Clackwood Sound. And that was the year before the big blockade. So that year I just, you know, it was 100 or 200 people, mostly from the local community. And I just supported them. I cooked and watched and learnt. I came back the following summer, and I was taking my master's now in environmental studies, and I thought, okay, I'll write my thesis and I'll volunteer at the Friends of Clackwood Sound. And most of the key organizers had all been arrested and had spent part of the winter in jail, and part of their return was that they couldn't go back to the blockade, to the Kennedy River Bridge. They weren't allowed within a certain distance.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden I found myself one of about six people who were the most experienced people, and it was 1993, and the government had just made the decision to log the majority of Clackwood Sound, and I started organizing, and we opened the Clackwood Peace Camp. And I remember thinking the first day, if we can get 100 people to get arrested this summer, that'll really change things. And, you know, the next 3 months we had 10,000 people come, and over 1,000 people got arrested, and that, you know, just changed my life, changed a lot of people's lives.
How did you end up with Greenpeace out of that?
Well, at the end of the summer, I mean, we had been, you know, working night and day, largest civil disobedience in Canada's history, and the logging continued, unabated. I mean, they were, you know, they were hauling 1,000-year-old trees out of that every day, and it was going to McMillan Bledel Mills to be made into the Pacific Bell Yellow Pages and Scott Paper's toilet paper. Karen Mahon, who's a very close friend of mine, was running the Greenpeace Canada campaign, and we sat down one day and we started talking about, well, if it's, you know, if they're not going to listen to people, if the polling is showing that, you know, 87% of Canadians don't support the Clackwood land use decision, and 1,000 people have been arrested, and that doesn't change anything, what will? You know, what's driving this? And we thought, okay, we're going to find out who's buying it. We're going to go talk to them. We had no skills, no systems, you know, we were literally following trucks, you know, which mill does that go to, okay, then we, you know, pretend to be a student and take the mill tour, and, you know, really, that's really interesting, and who buys this? Oh, Pacific Bell. that was our initial days of research. You know, we'd get a guy friend to go and hang out in the bars and, you know, try and pick up names of customers and things like that. It's a little more sophisticated these days. We actually have staff, that's all they do, chain of custody research tracking to figure out the product flows from Canada, because, you know, 80% of it is going down into the U.S. still. And so we've found a bunch of big named customers, and we bought plane tickets and bought my first suit and went off to Europe to meet with them, and got an enormous amount of pickup. I mean, a lot of the companies had been convinced by either the Canadian government or the logging companies themselves that they were only buying second growth forests and it was only selectively logged. They weren't buying any clear cutting. And so we would show them the proof. No, actually, you're buying clear cut temperate rainforests, you know, forests that are a result of 10,000 years of post-glacial activity, and some of the trees are 1,000 years old, and you're making toilet paper. And do you think your customers want to know this? And how do you think the public will feel about that? And so the first meeting I went to with Scott Paper, they were horrified. Then by the second meeting, I was no longer meeting with anyone who had any decision-making power. I was only meeting with their PR people. You know, that's all they would send into the meeting. So I went and talked to Greenpeace UK, and we mocked up these ads that had the little Andrex puppy. You know, they used to use these puppies following down the white stairs with the toilet paper, and we mocked up these ads that had the puppy with a little bubble that said, "I kill rainforests." And we just showed them the ad and said, "Okay, well, this is going to go as stickers, and we're going to have fleets of people going through the supermarkets putting these on all the toilet paper, and your choice. You choose. You've got 30 days. And they canceled their contract, and their contract was worth $3 million. And that was the beginning of the markets campaign. And, you know, we don't actually know how much money we cost them, but it was about 2 years later when we were doing a big campaign against Pacific Bell. We had these stickers that we put on telephone booths. Remember telephone booths? That
vaguely.
Said, yeah, said, "Let your fingers do the chopping." We were at the Pacific Bell annual general meeting, and we had locked down and turned the whole thing into a zoo. We had this massive phone in front of the AGM that rang every 60 seconds because there was an acre of rainforest destroyed every 60 seconds, and it rang so loud that it was disrupting the whole annual general meeting. And McMillan and Linda Cody, who was the vice president of McMillan Waddell, called me up and she said, "Okay, we can't take it. It's got to stop. None of our senior management can get any work done because they're just constantly fielding calls from customers, and what do we have to do?" And I said, "You have to stop logging Clackwood Sound." So they did.
Is that when you were declared an enemy of British Columbia by Glenn Clark?
That was a year later when we launched the Great Bear Rainforest Campaign and called for a boycott of all of the products of the three largest logging companies in British Columbia. And Clark responded to that press conference by calling me an enemy of the state.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's usually followed by an arrest. I've been at the center of controversy. It's not as fun as it sounds.
No, it was terrifying. I mean, what was I then? 25, 26, and the backlash was intense. You know, the McMillan Waddell was taking up full page ads in the newspaper. Greenpeace, will they wreck British Columbia?
Yeah,
you know that, our board was scared. A lot of people were canceling Greenpeace memberships, and we were getting death threats into the office, you know, every day. And it was pretty terrifying at the time. But there was, you know, there was a couple of people, kind of seasoned campaigners, who said to us, "You know what? This is the moment. Surf it. This is what you wanted to do. They're going to ignore you. We've been through that. And then they're going to ridicule you, and then eventually you're going to win." And so we just tried to turn the attention around and keep it going. And really the most important thing was that now people knew we were logging BC's coast and that there were rainforests there. Because post the Clackwood Sound campaign, you know, that whole region was called the Mid-Coast Timber Supply Area. I mean, the Great Bear Rainforest didn't exist.
Yeah.
You can't get there. No one knew about it. It wasn't like Tofino where people could drive up and see it for themselves. So we really needed a huge controversy to kick open the door.
How did that all happen?
That was Valerie Langer from the Friends of Clackwood Sound, and Karen Mahan and Ian McAllister from Raincoast. And we were in San Francisco trying to drum up support from U.S. groups. And we were sitting around at dinner one night, and I think Karen still has the paper tablecloth, you know, from some of those cheap, I think it was Italian restaurant, and we were writing, you know, Raincoast Wilderness, great wilderness, rainforest, you know, Great Bear, and you're crossing it out and going through it, and finally it was like Great Bear Rainforest. And we really wanted a name that immediately said something about the area. You know, we wanted the next Amazon. We wanted to be able to, for people to hear it and go, "How could anyone be making toilet paper out of that?"
Yeah.
And, you know, and obviously Ian is a scientist and knows the area so well, and he kept insisting it's got to have bear in it because it's the last stronghold, you know, for some of the most important, you know, for large mammals. I mean, for grizzly bears and Komodo bears, and if you look at the extirpation maps in North America, what you see is, you know, grizzly bears, for example, used to roam all through California. And now their habitat is shrunk right up, you know, to halfway up Canada. And you know, Canada really is the last frontier. And the great bear was the poster child for that. And now what we were trying to do was not only protect the great bear rainforest, but create a conversation about, you know, how we're going to interact with some of the most important wilderness areas left on the planet.
Well, I think you hit upon that name about the same time the spirit bear was starting to, unless I'm getting my timelines wrong, I think that was about the time people started hearing about the spirit bear for the first time as well.
Well, we use the spirit bear as the icon in the campaign, so it,
Okay. I wasn't sure if you'd started the spirit bear.
Well, the First Nations who live on the coast revered the spirit, you know,
of the media attention it was getting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of amazing groups in British Columbia who, for years, were working on the issues, but just not getting the traction. And we were able to build on their work, you know. So it, like Valhalla Wilderness Society, you know, Wayne McCrory has been out there working on the spirit bear issues for 20 years or more, and Raincoast, Peter and Ian McAllister, doing absolutely incredible work. And I think we were able just to tip it over the edge because we had big groups. We were able to engage big organizations like Rainforest Action Network and Natural Resources Defense Council and Greenpeace.
Tune in next time for part 2 of my interview with Sephora Berman. For the Green Chain Podcast, I'm Mark Laren-Young.